Just a heads up before you listen to this next episode of Let's Save the Governor General. This episode will discuss the Port Arthur Massacre, in which numerous people were killed, but we'll also cover the topics of gun massacres in general, and we do also discuss suicide and pedophilia at some stage, so heads up. And hopefully you'll enjoy this episode.
Hello, I'm Phoebe.
I'm Clancy.
And I'm Damien.
Now you might be asking, what do two Aussies and a Pom have in common?
Quite a lot, actually.
For starters, Her Majesty has her face on all our currencies.
Even the coins.
There's a great Union Jack floating around some flags as well.
And we speak the same language, sort of.
Somehow.
Allegedly.
And we love winding each other up.
What are we doing here, then?
Winding you up. But anyway, on this show, we discuss current Australian politics.
We take a look at past events.
While on a mission to ensure the Governor-General stays in their job.
What? I didn't sign up for this, what?
It's in the show's name, Phoebe. Welcome to Let's Save the Governor-General.
No, I don't want to. Kick him out.
What about her?
Or her. No, let's just not have a governor general. Let's have a republic.
With who is president?
Not ScoMo.
President ScoMo. President ScoMo.
No, President Julia Gillard.
President Craig Kelly.
Good evening. A siege is underway in the Tasmanian town of Port Arthur, where at least 25 people have been shot dead in Australia's worst massacre. Another 26 are wounded. The gunman is holding police at bay. He's believed to be holding at least one person hostage. Most of the victims are reported to be tourists visiting the historic penal colony at Port Arthur. And a warning that some of the pictures in this report may be disturbing.
Helicopters began ferrying the injured to Hobart from Port Arthur after a gunman opened fire there this afternoon.
We've had a gunman run amok on the Port Arthur historic site. That's 85 k's from Hobart. Happened mid-afternoon. There are at least 12 confirmed dead, if not 22. There's a further 15 injured, and at the moment we have a hostage and siege situation which we're attempting to contain and control.
28th of April 1996 sees the beginning of one of the darkest incidents in Australian history. Martin Bryant, in possession of a number of firearms, fatally shoots 35 people and wounds 23 in and around the historic tourist attraction Port Arthur, about an hour away from Hobart in Tasmania's far southeast, with the perpetrator being captured the next day, April the 29th, after a shootout with police. Martin Bryant is tried, pleads guilty, and is sentenced to 35 consecutive life sentences in Hobart's Risdon Prison, basically a death sentence without the execution. Many questions are asked about how and why, many tears are shed, many books are written. It is a fact that almost every discussion of the Port Arthur massacre eventually leads into a discussion of firearm control, and from there, every discussion about firearm control eventually revolves around the situation in America. But I think it is worth asking, is gun control the only context we should be looking at this in? And are there any other lessons from what happened nearly 30 years ago? To help with that, I would like to discuss this topic in all sincerity with my co-hosts Clancy, an actual Tasmanian resident, and Phoebe, who will present an international perspective. Now, before I get into the lead up to the events, ladies, I would like to get your thoughts on the day itself and the immediate aftermath.
It was one of those things that I will kind of remember knowing it happened, even though I was in Britain, because we have just had the Dunblane massacre. Yes, so Dunblane in Scotland was the deadliest UK school shooting in history. Gunman walked onto a school grounds and opened fire on a reception class in a gymnasium.
Wow. Yep.
And that was shortly before the Port Arthur massacre happened. And British media was wall to wall.
Yeah.
I was only a child at the time, but I still remember my mother at the time screaming.
Mm-hmm.
Not again, because there it was again on television. Places that are supposed to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
People being murdered.
Yes, that's quite heavy. And Clancy, I know you weren't in Tasmania at the time, but you were obviously in Australia, and so your thoughts and perspectives.
I was still in Sydney at that time, so I was still in... Look, I think, it definitely affected everybody in Australia, mm-hmm. and I guess the main thing and the obvious thing was the whole issue of the gun control, where he got the guns from, how it could have happened in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once I moved to Tassie, I actually came across several people who were first responders. One of my former managers, her husband was a paramedic. She was actually working at Nubina Health Centre, where several of the victims were taken as well. She knew a lot of people who were witnesses. And even today, continually people I'll meet were there or knew someone who was there or knew someone who got killed. So it's still very much in that Tasmanian consciousness.
So it is still a thing then, Clancy?
Oh, totally, totally. Okay. I mean, you'll both recall that a couple of years ago there was a movie made about it. That brought up quite a lot of angst in Tassie. I haven't actually seen it, and a lot of people refuse to see it because of that. Bryant's still in jail. So, he's still going, so.
Yep. And from all accounts, he looks completely different. Put in some context, he's gained a lot of weight and he does have the boyish blonde hair and all that. So,
From all accounts, from things I've heard, that he's not well psychiatrically, never was.
No.
And, he's put on a lot of weight, but that happens in prison because they sit there and eat and don't do anything. I even had a friend of mine who had told me that he'd had guns, he knew Martin Bryant, and that Martin had asked him for some of his guns. So there's so many connections that are still around, and it is definitely still in people's consciousness. We were down that way only a few weeks ago. There's still lots of tourists that go down there, and of course they've knocked down the original Arrow Cafe. Yep, where the massacre took place, and it's a memorial now. It's just a slab with a memorial, and they rebuilt the cafe further up. So it's changed a fair bit. My brother and my sister-in-law, when they came down to visit, did actually go and have a look, and they'd been there before the massacre and said it had changed a lot.
I was going to say, Port Arthur wasn't actually a residential town. Port Arthur was actually more of a national park, a tourist attraction managed by the Tasmanian government.
Well, the Port Arthur site is, the nearby towns like Nubina and White Beach and places like that, that always had permanent residents, but a lot of people had what they called shacks there. So it's very much a thing in Tassie where people have holiday shacks that they go to visit, and those tend to be a few of the places where they do have them. Anywhere there's a beach, basically, there's usually a bit of a shack community happening. No, there's still permanent residents down there. Part of what they think kicked the whole thing off was that Martin Bryant's father had wanted to purchase the Seascape property. Yeah, we drove past there, and it's quite a spectacular property. They were renting that out or planning to rent that out as a B&B, I believe. So they were the first ones to die, I believe.
Yep. So we'll get into the actual day itself. This is going to be a little bit of levity of the situation. I was actually asleep on the couch. I had the TV playing, and in my dream that I was having a dream about a gunman walking around the shooting people. And what I didn't realize was that, yeah, my dream was incorporating what I was hearing from the TV. So when I woke up, I was like, oh my God, this actually happened.
Were you thinking, am I still asleep?
Possibly, yes. And so I was in high school at the time, and the next day at school, it was like the biggest talking point. But yeah, so the first question I'm going to briefly ask is, was Martin Bryant mentally ill?
There was clearly something not 100% right with his mental state to take a firearm to a tourist attraction, kill his parents, shoot people in a cafe, and then walk to a bed and breakfast, take people hostage and set it on fire.
Because he did definitely have a reduced mental capacity and showed signs of Asperger's. However, he was actually ruled fit to stand trial.
Yes. And this is one of the things that is very difficult for people who aren't legally trained to fully appreciate when it comes to the assessment of a mental capacity of an individual to be held responsible for their actions. A declaration of insanity is virtually impossible to get because the bar is so high, and they're called the McNaughton rules, that you just virtually can't cross them. So the McNaughton rules set out a series of tests that you have to do in order to be able to establish under common law, so this will apply in Australia, as to whether someone can be declared insane and therefore completely incapable of understanding what they're doing.
Yep.
And these rules were tested when British Prime Minister Spencer Percival was assassinated. This is how far back we go. We're going back to the 1700s, 1800s with this case law. And the bar is so high, Thomas Bellingham tried to say he was insane and the judge wouldn't have it, even though he had just assassinated a prime minister of the UK. The judge wasn't having it. And the judge said, you would have to be drooling out of your mouth on one side and not able to understand what's going on in here to not fully appreciate what you had done. So to actually be declared insane is ridiculously high. So that's a non-starter. But diminished responsibility, on the other hand, that's saying that you had an inkling of some description as to what was going on, but did you know the difference between right and wrong? So you were in control of your actions, but were you appreciating your actions?
Okay, and I think this is where something like the drunk's defense comes into play, is that, like, if you drink drive and crash a car or run someone over, then you can say, look, I was drunk, I didn't, But that, I think that defense has been all but wiped out. So Martin Bryant initially pleaded not guilty. And the question I have is, so he later changed his plea to guilty, but I'm just trying to think, how would his defense have worked to try and get him off the charge?
If I was somebody defending him, so say I was a barrister that's hired to stand up in court and defend him, I would be looking at other failings to blame.
Okay.
Should he have been entitled to purchase the firearm in the first place? Should he have received better medical care in the first place? Did all of these things contribute to him falling below the standard of murder?
Okay.
And if they fell below the standard of murder, you can't find him guilty of murder. You may still find him guilty of manslaughter. If you can turn around and say, look, this failing happened, this failing happened, this failing happened, this failing happened. And without all of these failings happening, none of this would have happened. And he was not aware on the day of the things that he was doing. So say, for example, he was in a catatonic state throughout the whole thing.
yeah,
and he was not aware of what he was doing in that state, you could argue it was manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility as opposed to murder, where you have to have a mens rea of some form of intent and understanding of that intent.
And I think that's where his defence was trying to go. They were trying to argue that he had diminished responsibility due to his mental state. And then I think they realised that it wasn't going to wash. And if they pled not guilty, he was probably, well, I mean, he ended up getting 35 life sentences anyway. So he's, you know.
I think that any legal counsel who was, even the Cleaver Greens of this world, would have turned around to the client and said, plead guilty. Because you have a responsibility as legal counsel to ensure that you uphold justice itself and you uphold the rule of law. And you don't make an affront to justice and the rule of law. And you also have a duty not to bring the legal profession or the court system into disrepute as an officer of the court. So if you stand up there and you make defences that you yourself know are complete rubbish, you yourself will be in front of the bar standards council of whatever state you're in, and you'll be told you should have advised your client to plead guilty and you should have withdrawn from the case.
Yep. Because just saying that, the O.J. Simpson trial comes to mind, and I say this because as of time recording, O.J. Simpson has recently passed away.
Yes.
And everything, every mention of him will refer back to his the trial of the century, where, like, I think it's clear. I think it's clear cut. It's very highly likely, on the balance of probabilities, that he did kill his ex-wife and her friend.
A civil court said he was liable for their deaths.
Yes, but in the criminal trial.
So, just more on the O.J. Simpson trial, just to divert slightly as to what we're meaning here, is that the lawyers in this case, the attorneys in this case, actually had arguable evidentiary matters that you could bring evidentiarily before a court that raised reasonable doubts. So during the O.J. Simpson trial, his defense team had gone frame by frame through thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of TV footage. And they found failings to do things properly by criminalists, coroners, police officers, and so on, which raised a reasonable suspicion as to how evidence was collected. They had problems with the coroner's report, and Dr. Michael Golden was the coroner's name in this case, and the failures of him to do certain routine blood work, the failures of him to retain the contents of the stomach, and so on. And with the O.J. Simpson trial, there were no eyewitnesses apart from a dog. So it was arguable in the O.J. Simpson case that there was a reasonable doubt that could be raised to say that it wasn't O.J. Simpson. Whereas in this case, I don't think such a reasonable doubt existed.
So the lead up. It's not controversial to say that Martin Bryant, born in 1967, had a childhood disturbed by issues to do with his diminished intellectual capacity. But interestingly, these were not from external factors. Bryant grew up in a loving and protective middle-class family. Even at an early age, though, Bryant's parents knew he wasn't developing like other children. And I say this to contrast with the Snowtown murders, where almost everyone involved in the Snowtown murders were abused as children and lived in lower-class socioeconomic environments. Now, I'm going to say there were four factors to the Port Arthur massacre. Intellectual capacity issues, the power to indulge in violent fantasies, the freedom to indulge in violent fantasies, and then the tipping point. So the first I'm going to raise is intellectual capacity issues. Bryant wasn't necessarily schizophrenic, so that can be ruled out. But suffice to say that numerous assessments made during his lifetime indicated that he had a sub-70 IQ and was ruled as having a diminished employment capacity, as well as an inability to relate to people. Thus, he was on a disability pension for his adult life. Was he misfit? Yes. Did he understand what he was doing? That's very hard to say, but I think we'll tail off to a discussion, but I think it's fair to say that he's ever since he was a child, he did have that. I suppose misfit is probably the nicest word we can say for someone of his mental capacity.
He was an oddity.
Reports came out that said that, you know, he did enjoy making people angry and tormenting other kids and that kind of stuff.
I do remember in my research for this episode that he was described as an individual who was an unorthodox character when it came to interacting with other children.
Look, I mean, if it was these days, he probably would have been diagnosed with an conduct disorder, an oppositional defiance disorder, and probably, I mean, definitely on the spectrum.
An antisocial behaviour disorder.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, but the fact he was born in 67 means that during the 70s, that support network that we have now, there was no NDIS.
Well, having said that, I mean, he became independently wealthy in his adulthood, because a friend of the family's, when she died, left him a bunch of money.
So the second factor I think in here is the power to indulge, and that is an interesting story in and of itself. Now, the power that came to indulge in his fantasies came from the large fortune that he inherited from firstly his father, but also a benefactor, Mary Harvey. Mary Harvey herself was a benefactor in a share of the Tattersall's lottery fortune. And if you know the name Tats Lotto, if you live in Victoria or other places, Tats Lotto, to which Tattersall's lends its name. And Bryant and Mary Harvey met while Martin Bryant was walking the neighborhood to get customers for his lawn mowing side hustle that his dad roped him into to give him something to do. And Mary Harvey herself was, let's say, a rich loner who embodied the crazy cat lady stereotype. She reportedly had 14 dogs and 40 cats on her property, and it's quite possible that she was of diminished capacity as well, given that the authorities intervened on at least one occasion.
Having looked into this, there was some question as to whether there was a romantic involvement between the two of them, which led to the benefactoring to him. There has been no concrete evidence to support this, but it was raised during the investigations. Well, were these two people actually, you know, a romantic item and so on? But everybody that they interacted with denied that this was a thing and that they were just two misfits who found each other and clicked quite well as two misfits.
Yes. And we do need to focus in part on Mary Harvey's issues as well. Harvey lived with her mother, Hilsa, though she was essentially neglected. In the two-story house they lived in, Harvey and Bryant lived upstairs and let the dogs have free rein downstairs, where the mother was found unable to move or fend for herself due to an undiagnosed broken hip. So Harvey and Bryant became best friends and moved in together, and after their property was raided, they then relocated to a farm about an hour out of Hobart, where both Bryant and Harvey were a bit more free of social restraints.
So I hadn't realised that Martin was actually in the accident that killed her. He was in the vehicle, and there were some reports that she'd said that he used to lunge at the steering wheel and it almost caused accidents. And
correct, yes. So, however, apparently in the police report, Bryant said that they were distracted by the three dogs in the back that were fighting. Apparently, according to friends, Bryant had a habit of lunging at the steering wheel, and Harvey herself was reported as saying that one day that little bastard's going to kill me.
Yeah.
So they would travel about with the animals in the back seat of their car, and Harvey was well known to car dealers, having regularly purchased numerous vehicles in her time with her fortune. So Mary Harvey bequeathed her properties and her wealth to Martin Bryant. And also after his father passed away, Martin Bryant got even more money. So he had properties, he had money. So that, to me, that gave him the power to indulge. So when you got, when you have freedom, when you have that amount of money and you don't need to work or look after a family.
He was obviously a misfit from day one. And he obviously had some really negative personality and character traits, which meant that it made it very difficult for him to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones he did make were quite eccentric. Yeah, exactly. Yep. And then suddenly he's got all of this money, he can do whatever he likes, and he's still not able to make friends. It almost makes you feel sorry for him, almost.
An interesting, I suppose, conundrum is that, you know, did he really understand? Well, actually, I will ask the big question at the end. There's a big question I've got at the end. Mm-hmm. So to me, the third factor is the freedom. And to me, two harnesses broke that kind of sealed Martin Bryant's fate. The first was the death of Mary Harvey in a car accident. There is speculation that Bryant impulsively lunged at the steering wheel occasionally as they were driving, and Bryant said to the police that no, that was because of the dogs in the back. One might put the relationship between Harvey and Bryant as mother and son, with nothing to indicate that the relationship was sexual, and in a way, two kindred spirits found each other. But however you define it, she was a restraint on him doing even more antisocial and obnoxious things than what he was already doing.
He was given barriers with which to roll within in the same... I look at the relationship they had, having researched this for this episode, as I see it like him being a bowling ball going down an alley, and she was the bumpers down the side, stopping him going into the gutter.
Yep. That and his father, Maurice Bryant. Maurice Bryant was an ever-present figure in his son's life, becoming a leash for him like his mother put him on when he was younger and helping him navigate adulthood. Bryant Sr. had a court order in place to see that his son was taken care of. And apparently there was actually a financial order on him as well, so that he didn't have access to all of his money at once, but he had it in drips and drabs. Now, there is speculation that Martin Bryant killed his father. Apparently there was a note on the front door of Martin Bryant's farmhouse that said, "Call the cops." Maurice Bryant was found down in a puddle or in a body of water with weights on him. However, his death was ruled a suicide. Maurice Bryant's will, he left a sum of money to his son Martin. Yeah, so to me, the fact that two of the most important people in his life have now gone, the restraints are off.
So yeah, just for the record, I disagree with the finding of suicide in that matter.
Okay.
Having looked into it, and the reason I disagree with it is because it's too unexplainable. And the laws around suicide were, in Australia in particular, were made known when Michael Hutchins died, the lead singer of INXS. Was there a suicide in that matter? And there were documentaries after documentaries after documentaries in the UK about how his death was ruled a suicide, when in the UK it would have been ruled death by misadventure. And having looked into the Michael Hutchins case and then looking into the death of the father that was ruled a suicide, I do see that the suicide rules in Australia do allow coroners much more wider leeway when there's a lot of unanswered questions to say this is a suicide. Whereas in Britain, it would have been an open verdict or death by misadventure or unlawful killing, even potentially in that matter, because it was that weird the way that he died.
Michael Hutchence died in 1997, so not too long.
It is a comparative coronial law comparison.
I'm going to go to the tipping point, and to me, the tipping point was the Dunblane Massacre.
The class that died, massacred by a crazed gunman. Parents in anguish as the grim news spread. The killer was a local man with a known grudge. Tonight, a traumatized community is changed forever. Good evening. In three appalling minutes today, in the small city of Dunblane in central Scotland, 16 children were murdered. A former scout leader with a grudge walked into their primary school gymnasium with four handguns and, without warning, opened fire. The children who died were all 5 and 6 year olds. Their teacher, Gwen Mayer, seen here with her class in the autumn, was also killed. Almost all the children in the picture who weren't killed were wounded, some seriously. The killer, Thomas Hamilton, finally shot himself dead. He was known to the authorities as an unstable loner, and schools had been warned not to let him onto their premises.
I can't say I actually remember the Dunblane Massacre. I think that just passed under my consciousness at the time.
Yeah, Thomas Hamilton murdered 17 people, 16 of them children aged 5 or 6, and their teacher. And then himself. And if any of you are tennis fans, you will probably have heard of this because Andy Murray was a pupil at this school when this happened. He was not in that class. He was nowhere near that class, but he was at the school when it happened. And this was the biggest galvanizing factor in 1996 for gun control legislation to be passed in the United Kingdom. So at the time, the then Prime Minister, John Major, and the leader of the opposition, Tony Blair, went to visit Dunblane, and they passed comprehensive firearms regulations in the UK that made it illegal in the UK to own a handgun. Full stop. So in Britain, you cannot own a handgun for any reason. Even if you are an Olympic shooter, you may not own a handgun.
Well, now, I'm going to ask, was gun violence, was that a big issue in Britain up to that time?
Periodically, it had been, because prior to that, you had the Monkston Massacre, the Highferias Massacre, the Hungerford Massacre, the Westminster Massacre. All of these things had happened within the previous 10, 12 years of the Dunblane Massacre. So the Hungerford Massacre was a big one before that, where a man went around in Hungerford, Berkshire, got out of his car and just started murdering people in the street.
In Australia, up until the late 90s, Australia also did have a number of firearm-related incidents that resulted in multiple casualties. However, most of those resolved around either family disputes or organised crime. Very rarely did we see someone just walk out in public and start shooting random strangers. Though, having said that, the Holder Street Massacre, and I think Russell Street as well. So there are two people currently in Victorian jails who are convicted of gun-related offences by walking down the street and just shooting people. So it did happen in Australia as well, not to this level and not to...
We're not talking American levels of gun violence here.
No.
But we are talking, for countries where there is restrictive gun ownership, more than you would want to occur. You would expect a tolerance level of, okay, these happen very rarely and very occasionally, because you will have individuals that go around and do these things. But in Britain, you could usually say every 3 or 4 years, something like this would happen.
Which is still 3 or 4 years too many, but yeah. Yes. But however, it's not weekly.
It's not, unfortunately, in the United States where it's a school shooting that happens on a regular basis, almost. I say a very good friend of mine was a teacher at Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Oh, yikes.
Who had the day off, the day of the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. Mm-hmm. And everyone had thought that she had died in massacre because she was asleep in her basement.
Oh, no. Yep.
And they erroneously, to begin with, listed her as one of the dead because nobody could get hold of her. So they had assumed these are the people we can't get hold of. She was a PE teacher and she knew every single child who was murdered.
So with the Dunblane massacre, what was the motivation?
He had a grudge against the education system and children because he was a scouting leader and he had been thrown out of the scouts. And he bore a grudge against that. And as the newsreader said, they had said to him, do not let him on your premises. It was very much one of those things where he had an incident that happened and he bore a grudge. And the incident happened in the 1970s. And he waited until the 1990s to do this. As if this episode couldn't get any heavier, Thomas Hamilton was accused of being a paedophile. He was said to have somebody, he was said in a report to be a suspicious of the moral intentions towards boys that he had as he, on scouting trips, quote, forced boys to sleep in close proximity to him inside his van during a hill walking expedition, end quotes.
I suppose a more rational motivation there, whereas in Martin Bryant's case, so on the actual day of, on the 28th of April, 1996, from the reports that came out, the massacre started in the afternoon where he had gone to, now I think Clancy mentioned this, Seascape. So Seascape was a bed and breakfast along the Tasmanian coast that Maurice Bryant apparently wanted to purchase and retire there. The owners didn't want to sell. And there is a line of thought that those two people were chosen to be killed first by Martin Bryant because of the deep depression that Maurice Bryant apparently fell into after his attempt at purchase was rejected. Those two died first. Martin Bryant then drove down to Port Arthur, parked his car, went into the Arrow Cafe. And within, I think, the space of about 15 seconds, he let off, you know, a good 30 shots, killed a number of people. People started running. People started running towards the beach. Martin Bryant walked in between the coaches that were there, walked towards the beach, you know, started shooting indiscriminately. And that some people had to play dead to not get shot. Afterwards, Martin Bryant got into, I think he actually stole a car.
There was a carjacking, yes.
Yeah.
So he went to a service station as well. And at the service station, he murdered people and he also took a hostage at the service station. Then he moved back towards Seascape and that's where he killed more people on the roadway. And then he actually went back to Seascape itself. Yeah.
And then overnight, there was a shootout with police. And then in the morning, they set fire to Seascape, apparently with the hostage inside.
Yes.
And yes.
The thing that got me from the immediate reactions to the shooting that happened at the historical site was people thought it was a reenactment originally. There were people who were interviewed afterwards that had survived that said, we didn't realise this was not a reenactment. We didn't realise it wasn't supposed to be because it's a historical site. You've got historical artifacts, and we just thought that the shooting was something that was just going on in an exhibition that we weren't attending.
Now, I'm going to pause you there for a sec, Phoebe. Port Arthur was an historic site because of what happened. I think that whalers, there was a whaling station from, Clancy may be able to clarify this.
It was a penal colony, so I think it got settled first as they used to do whaling there, and then it got turned into a penal colony. There's an island just in that bay too that was used for the female prisoners. Have you ever done the tour there, Damien?
Not me, no.
Still mostly, I guess, intact. There's still some buildings that are intact, but a lot of them have you know, got ruined in various fires and things like that. But it's still, you know, historically still quite interesting. You can go out on the boat trip and have a look at the, I think it's called Sarah Island off the top of my head now, I can't remember. And they'll sort of take you on the tour and, you know, sometimes that includes whale watching as well. But, you know, it's a very popular tourist destination even now. Difficult, I guess, sometimes for the locals to deal with, put it that way. It's an interesting place to visit because the town itself is quite small, not a lot there, and it's mostly revolves around the tourists. You know, I still do a lot of tourism from the site as well, but very beautiful, but sad.
A psychiatrist would later say it was Brian's ultimate attempt to regain control by doing what he had done since childhood, taking delight and excitement in tormenting and hurting others. And does make some sort of sense. So on the aftermath, I'll go to the aftermath. In the aftermath of the Port Arthur massacre, and just like with the Dumblay massacre, firearm control became the number one talking point. In particular, in Australia, the states had a hodgepodge of gun control laws that weren't cross-applicable. So you could easily go to another state, buy a gun, take it back to your state, which is a bit more restrictive. But it's also worthy of note that in Martin Bryant's case, apparently he bought a gun without a license as well. So there were some guns that he purchased legally at a gun shop, but then there were some that he got through private sale as well. So he was able to both legally and illegally get a cache of weapons.
And he also stole the weapons from the Seascape property once he killed them too.
True, yes, they did forget about that. So gun control became a big issue, and John Howard, you could say, risked his prime ministership, but also risked his life in introducing a gun buyback scheme. And there is a – Phoebe, as I'm talking, can you find the photo of John Howard in a bulletproof vest for me?
Oh, yeah.
John Howard went to country Victoria to try convince the farmers and the locals to give up their guns. And someone gave John Howard advice that, you know, you may be shot at.
Give me one second, I will find that.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. But yes, even now, though, gun control is still a big issue. Since the Port Arthur massacre, there was the Melbourne gangland wars in which people shot at each other willy-nilly.
It's sort of interesting if you go through the list of massacres in Australia before and after the Port Arthur massacre, and most of them leading up to that were by gun or by arson. And then after that, there were still a few by gun, but most of them were stabbings and arson.
And just to bring a point up, I said before, was that most of the massacres were family disputes and gangland or organized crime, which is still...
Yeah, they were targeted.
Yes, exactly.
Which is why, you know, this most recent, the Westfield Bondi Junction stabbing was... So I guess focused on was because it wasn't targeted.
I think it's a good segue, Clancy, in that last weekend, last Saturday, a gentleman named Joel Couchy went to the Westfield Shopping Centre in Bondi, which I think is northern Sydney, or is it southern Sydney?
Eastern.
And, basically went through and I think he killed five women.
Six people.
And injured a number of people, including a nine-month-old baby.
Yeah. So, I think 12 people were hospitalised afterwards. One of the people who died was the nine-month-old baby's mother. There's some discussion about whether or not, because most of the victims were women, there's been speculation that he was specifically targeting women and that the men that, you know, were killed were sort of incidental to that. Don't know if that's true or not. I don't think there's been a, you know, comprehensive analysis of it yet. It's still in process. But he sounds like he had some severe mental health issues himself.
Yep, and unfortunately Joel Couchy was shot by police at the scene, which led to his death.
That's great.
He can no longer speak for himself.
Yeah.
So up on the screen, I do have the famous picture of John Howard in a bulletproof vest.
You can clearly see the outline of the bulletproof vest under his jacket.
There, you can just see up the top there, $500 million save if we spent on medical research. So even then, people were concerned about medical research as well. So that's good to know. Good to know.
How many children would $500 million save if put on medical research? Is what the sign says.
Yep. So now, my next talking point was social media. Now, luckily, I suppose luckily is maybe the wrong word, but this took place in a time well before the proliferation of social media. And I'm going to contrast this with Brenton Tarrant. Brenton Tarrant is an Australian who went to New Zealand, who killed 51 people and injured 40, and actually live streamed his actions on Facebook.
On Kiwi Farms as well.
However, in this case, Tarrant was actually more fighting a political battle.
He was a neo-Nazi that went to a mosque and shot up a mosque. So Brenton Tarrant is best known as the Christchurch Mosque Massacre Man.
Yes, and that actually, I think, led to New Zealand implementing their own gun reforms. What I'm trying to say is that Brenton Tarrant had more of a political motivation for what he did. The person who did the Dunblane Massacre had a...
personal...
yeah, a personal reason, whereas Martin Bryant, I think he, I suppose, for want of a better word, hated society because he didn't fit in.
Well, and I mean, part of that, I guess, too, was the parallel to the Dunblane massacre in there was some stuff cited that he'd actually, you know, wanted the attention that the Dunblane massacre perpetrator had gotten. And it was like, you know, you'll see I can do... you know, I can be famous too, sort of thing. If that was part of it, I don't know. It's interesting to wonder what those motivations outside of the family circumstances were. I think it's interesting that the Bondi Junction Westfield massacre was deemed to not be a terrorist attack because it didn't seem to have targeted particularly. But then the subsequent stabbing at the church has been called a terrorist attack.
Yeah, because apparently the bishop there was very critical of Islam, and a report I read said that the stabber had yelled at the bishop, "How dare you insult my religion?" I don't know if that is true, but that's just what I've read. And Phoebe's actually brought up a point just on social media and to do with the Bondi Junction stabbing, that this gentleman here, Benjamin Cohen, was incorrectly identified as the attacker by Channel 7.
And he is now suing, at time of recording, Channel 7.
Hasn't Channel 7 done that before?
Yes.
Yes.
They really need to sort out their issues.
They really do need to stop going to court, don't they? They've been really in court recently. They were hauled over the coals with someone else very recently at time of recording, and they're going to go to court again.
Yes, and just there's a name I've highlighted that is actually going to bridge this topic and our next recording. So just good that name's up on screen. So yes, so I'm just I suppose I'm glad that this didn't happen in the age of social media.
It could potentially have been a lot more grisly. The internet and social media has been a wonderful platform for those wishing to perpetuate what would have otherwise have been news stories.
Yeah, true. Now, Clancy also mentioned, she mentioned a movie, and I said, Clancy, hold your horses, and this is what I'm going to discuss now, Nitram. Now, Nitram is actually Martin spelled backwards. There's a nice one. I'm going to say it's a fantastic movie. It really gives you a character display of a person based on the character of Martin Bryant. I'd say it gets probably 80% of the story right. So the movie Nitram portrays a person who is basically never named, but his name in the movie is Nitram, and it does show, you know, a young blonde kid who struggles to fit in, who then makes friends with a lonely heiress, who then move, and then the movie was actually filmed in Geelong, which is not too far from my part of the world. And yeah, I was going to say it does get about 80% of the character right. However, the problem is that Martin Bright wasn't actually a loner. He actually was in a relationship with a woman at the time he committed his atrocities and apparently had a string of girlfriends leading up to the time. There's also reports that he had a history of perverse behavior towards young girls as well. But yeah, Clancy, your thoughts before I interrupted you there.
Look, I don't know. I haven't really read anything about that and the circumstances mm-hmm. around that, and I haven't seen the movie yet. I have intended to, but it's just not come up on my radar, so I can't really comment on that because I'm.
As a movie buff, I think it is a good movie. If you've seen Snowtown, the movie Nitram is made by the same director as Snowtown. Pretty hard hitting as well.
Well, interestingly enough, the one of the Snowtown convicteds recently been released, I believe.
That is actually correct, yes. He's on parole, and good luck to him. Good luck to him. So yeah. To me, the Port Arthur Massacre is a tale of power in the wrong hands and of social exclusion. Bryant came into a large fortune that enabled him to do what he did, because two socially excluded people connected, along with very lax gun laws. Did his parents have the support services available knowing they had an intellectually disabled child? But I'm going to ask the very, very hard question that I want to get your answers to. Was Martin Bryant evil?
No.
I think he was very disturbed. I don't know if he was evil. I don't believe in evil per se. I believe that sometimes mm-hmm. people who deliberately undertake actions with a known endpoint themselves maybe could be described as evil, but I don't think it's a naturally occurring thing.
I would not use the term evil to describe this man, because to use the term evil to describe Martin Bryant would put him on the same pedestal as those who have committed what are genuinely unspeakable crimes against humanity itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are very few people that I reserve that term evil for.
Yep.
Harold Shipman mm-hmm. being one of them. The
yep.
Dr. Death.
Mm.
Being one of them.
Yep.
This individual did a single act in a single place against those who, by happenstance, were caught up in his unhinged and unpredictable actions that were perpetuated and allowed to occur by the systemic issues that were around at the time. Mm-hmm. Going back to his childhood and his intellectual disability, to his upbringing, to his support structures being removed from him, to the Tasmanian government resistance to federal unified Australian gun laws,
mm-hmm.
all contributed towards what was and will probably be the worst mass murder in Australian history by a single individual.
Yep.
Well, I hope it never gets passed, that's for sure.
And it was the worst single mass murder by a single individual in the world at the time.
Mm.
This was subsequently only surpassed by the Las Vegas shooting of a country mm-hmm. music festival. And I'd like to touch on the gun control laws in Australia at the time, because this wasn't something that individuals had said was not a political issue. It most certainly was. And there had been multiple attempts over the decades under Liberal and Labour governments. So Fraser government, the Whitlam government, the Hawke-Keating government, they'd all tried to implement some kind of unified gun control, but the only state that kept saying no over and over and over and over again was Tasmania.
Yep.
And one of the state premiers at the time said, is it going to take a mass murder in Tasmania to get them on board?
Yeah, I think that was a New South Wales state premier, wasn't it?
Will it take Tasmania having a mass murder to get them on board with gun control?
Yeah.
Ironically, that's what it took.
That's exactly what it took.
Tragically, that is what it took.
And I think then, of course, you have to go to, you know, what's it going to take for America to tighten up their gun laws? Wow. Like, seriously.
Now, I suppose I don't want to dwell too long on America, but the biggest difference between America, Britain, and then Australia, Britain, and then America is that in America, it is a constitutionally guaranteed right to be able to carry a firearm, whereas in Australia and Britain, those are more legislated rather than constitutionally enshrined.
Mm-hmm. So the Second Amendment of the United States has a lot of interpretations, but the current interpretation is that a well-regulated militia means the people itself. So it says, Congress shall enact... So if you give me just 1 second, I will read the actual text of the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which reads as follows. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary for the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. And that has been interpreted to mean that the regulation of firearms is very limited.
What will it take to get America to tighten its gun laws?
And there are competing legal opinions as to what those terms mean and what they actually do mean. It has been said a well-regulated militia means an army and a police force, not everybody. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't mean it can't be regulated, but some people say that shall not be infringed means...
no restrictions at all.
No restrictions at all. And does being necessary to the security of a free state, does that allow anybody to just own anything?
Mm.
I mean, under the National Firearms Act of 1934, there are certain restrictions on certain firearms and weapons in the United States. Like you cannot own a cannon or an automatic machine gun, for example.
A cannon. There's a...
Yes. So yes. It has certain things that you cannot... So short-barreled rifles and suppressors, they are all covered by it. Machine guns are covered by it. Cannons are covered by it. But that's about it. National Firearms Act of 1934. It doesn't actually have that much in it. Okay. And... I look just across the water from where I live at the city of Windsor. And I stand where I stand in the city of Detroit. And in the city of Windsor, gun control is a lot stricter in Canada. Mm-hmm. Yet the ownership of guns is not as per capita as low as you would expect. But Canada does not have people wandering around going doing mass shootings. So it must be something more than just the propensity to own firearms.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Look, we could spend a whole another episode about the American gun control situation, but I think in the end with Port Arthur, I think it's fair to say that Australia learnt a valuable lesson.
Tasmania learnt a tragic lesson.
Yes, but I think they learned on one hand the lesson about gun control, but I think we also need to learn the lesson about support for people with mental health issues.
And I think from a legal point of view, it does raise the issue of the single state veto for on public safety grounds.
Mm.
Because it was just one state in the end going no, which killed a lot of gun control attempts in Australia. And some people will argue that's federation. But when you are being a holdout over decades, it does raise the issue of should the federal government in that situation be able to say, hang on a minute,
mm-hmm.
what are you playing at?
Yep. Interesting.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
Let's end it there and
yeah. And I say I would personally and on behalf of my two co-hosts like to dedicate this episode to the victims of gun violence everywhere, but specifically to the individuals who were killed at Port Arthur and the other locations and in Dunblane in Scotland.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, let me... Cool. I'll mark that. Whew, what a heavy...
Yeah. What a heavy episode. I think we might need to take five and then, you know, get into a different headspace to talk about, you know, something else which is equally as heavy.
What I'll do is I'll stop this recording and then I'll send you both a new link and I'll see you in that new link.
So,
in history's page, let every state advance Australia fair, in joyful strains that land.